work Ascending by Ralph Vaughan Williams, that performance by violinist Nicola Benedetti, and the London Philharmonic led by Andrew Litton. The last time I heard you both together, I was there, the night you gave the world premiere of that big new piece by Sir John Taverner, also on this album. I was actually there, yeah.
Oh, wow. But I broke the E string.
Broke the E string. And instead of the leader handing you his fiddle,
I usually changed it.
And it was a great moment because Andy turns to the audience after you left the stage and said, well, speak among yourselves.
Yeah.
And it was, and the most astounding thing was the extent to which you got right back into it. And the concentration didn't seem to have been broken at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those experiences you just pray not to happen too often. But I've had a few things like that happen to me. And you do just, you're just desperate to get back into it. That you just want it, that moment to be over and to get back into the piece and finish what you started. So I think that was just my whole focus was just on that and hoping that, you know, we would get through to the end smoothly.
Yeah. Oh, you sure did. You sure did. And of course, in the 19th century, string breaking was a great event because Liszt apparently would deliberately file piano strings so they would pop at the right moment and he would have to.
Dramatic, yes.
Yes.
Dramatic effect.
Yes. Well, one of the world's great violinists, Nicola Benedetti, has stopped in this evening. This in advance of some concerts with the Pacific Symphony this weekend. She's playing the first violin concerto of Max Bruch. We're going to be playing some of her many recordings tonight and talking about whatever she feels like talking about. Nicola Benedetti, welcome to KUSC.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
I don't know how many times it's, for how many years running, the listeners of Classic FM in Britain voted The Lark Ascending their favorite classical work. It was 4 or 5 years.
Oh, it's
straight.
Quite incredible.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Seems to be a consistent favorite with the British people. And yet, a piece that is very, very unknown to a lot of listeners and a lot of musicians in Europe and definitely in the States. And I mean, I think performed it more in the States than I have in Europe, in sort of Germany or France. And many of my colleagues, even some of them that have studied in the UK but studied with Eastern European teachers, had never heard of Lark Ascending and had never heard the piece. It was sort of an unknown to them. And I actually didn't know the piece at all until I left Yehudi Menuhin School. I had a Russian violin teacher there. He had a sort of quite a set repertoire that she expected her students to follow. And Lark Ascending definitely was not in there. And likewise, my teacher after that, Polish violin teacher, Maciek Rakowski, he didn't really know very much of the Lark Ascending. So for me to record it, although I'm British, I was actually coming to the piece quite fresh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a funny thing in Britain to the present day. I mean, I used to do this yearly Record of the Year show with James Jolly, the editor-in-chief of the Gramophone. And the year that Vernon Handley's recording of all the Bach's symphonies was released and was up for a Record of the Year award, this incredibly important album that ends the argument forever. I mean, you can never again claim that these are not among the greatest symphonies ever written by anyone anywhere. And yet, the editors of the Gramophone gave Record of the Year to a very fine, admittedly, recording of The Marriage of Figaro, which has been recorded a few times in the past. there's something, and it's true in this country, too. I mean, there's something about the British people not quite recognizing how great their composers are.
Right. Oh, but we have a terribly defeatist attitude and don't necessarily like to big up our own. I mean, we have that in Scotland, we have that in England. We tend to have a slight bashfulness about everything. It's very strange. And I do a lot of work with children learning to play instruments, and getting them to have that self-confidence is one of the things I have to work on the most. Just, you know, you are worth making a great sound on your instrument. Just have some belief in it. And it's a really odd trait that we have, but it's very I think it's quite significant.
Yeah, yeah. The American variation on that is, until very recently, to be the conductor of a major American orchestra, you had to be one of three things, preferably all three at the same time: an elderly, white, male, foreigner. And now, of course, you know, you can hire an American since Lenny, but he was the first, really.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there is an attraction to, I mean, I think in America, so much of the music having originated in Europe, I can imagine the more popular that music became in America, of course, there's a sense of sort of authenticity if you have a European conductor. I can imagine that. That being an attraction, but sure. It's good to hear that that's changing.
Yes, it is.
I wasn't even necessarily aware of it. So.
Yeah. Well, let's continue with something from your very first album. And when it came out, before I even heard a note of it, I said, anybody who does a debut with one of the two most physically beautiful violin concertos composed in the 20th century is my kind of fiddle player. And, you know, to coin a cliche, which of the two Szymanowski concertos, I think, is the most beautiful. Depends on which one I'm hearing at that moment. Mm. I mean, if one isn't, the other certainly is. Mm.
I do prefer the first of the two, mostly because the second, I think, is a little bit more similar to many other violin concertos in its form, and it's quite sort of folky. I think that ethereal quality that Szymanowski has, he just uses to the maximum in the first concerto, and I also think it's one that suits the violin so incredibly well. So you're always sort of up in the stratosphere and incredibly sort of high positions and very long lines, and it's I would say I prefer the first, but they're both wonderful pieces, and,
yeah.
And I'm happy to say I think being performed a lot more now. I actually see them in a lot of seasons of orchestral, you know, brochures and things. I see the Szymanowski program, so I'm always cheering for it.
Yeah, well, it's two of us. That's two of us. It's a strange question. How Italian do you really feel? I'm third generation Czech, and I feel intensely Czech. I mean, when Dvořák gets played, you know, gets played a lot on this show because he's a paisan of mine. So how intensely do you feel that?
I would say quite intensely. My makeup is more Italian than it is Scottish, my mum being half Italian and my father being Italian. I feel happiest in Italy. I feel most at home in Italy. But then again, so do many people. Italy is just one of those extremely loved countries.
Yes, mostly 19th century English poets. You know, they all just...
No, I think it's quite a sort of typical pattern. My parents both came to Scotland when they were very young, 3 and 10, in fact. And they were desperate to fit in as much as possible and inevitably be as Scottish as possible. And so I was born into that environment where my parents weren't speaking Italian to each other because my mother's Scottish grandparents refused to allow Italian to be spoken at home. And so all my grandparents obviously spoke Italian, and I was very aware of that, but my parents didn't encourage us to learn Italian, and it wasn't really enforced very much on us. And I think as I grew up, from a purely personal perspective, I grew more and more fascinated by Italy and more in love with Italy and everything Italian, but also from an artistic standpoint as well. I mean, music and architecture and visual art, all of these things, to know that, you know, this is a career path I had chosen, and the country I'm from has such a hugely rich heritage in that respect. So I think the fascination just continues, and I would actually like to live there one day, even if it be just for a year or two. It's something I would really love to do.
Any part especially?
I don't know. I have to think somewhat practically because I travel so much. So from that perspective, possibly Rome, but I would love to be everywhere. It's going to be difficult to choose.
Yeah, if you live in my favorite part, Umbria, it's really tough. I mean, it's a slog.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't do that. I couldn't have to take trains and an extra plane before I can then get out. I just I spend too many hours traveling as it is. I don't really wish to add another 5 hours onto each trip.
There you go. There you go. Well, let's hear something from that latest album, Italia, one of the Vivaldi concertos on the album. This is as popular and as frequently played and as played by as many violinists as this stuff is. This is tough music to play.
Yeah, it's very difficult. This is the Grosso Mogul. It's a very difficult piece and one I didn't know before searching for music for this recording. And, I mean, the cadenzas written for this concerto are really fiendishly difficult. And the second movement being this crazy improvisation that sounds so bizarre in so many ways. It sounds so new to my ears. I can't imagine how it would have sounded then. And even just the rhythmic qualities of the first and last movement are just so infectious. For me this piece was like a find of a new Four Seasons, you know, something that was really has the ability to grasp everyone and bring them in.
Latest recording, the one called Italia. That was that new recording from Niccolo Benedetti of the Violin Concerto in D Major, Riom Listing 208, The Grosso Mogul by Antonio Vivaldi. The Scottish Chamber Orchestra was led by Christian Kernan. And I hate to disclose a well-kept secret, but the Scottish Chamber Orchestra is a terrific band. I mean, they've been for decades now.
They are absolutely brilliant. And in actual fact, I would say all the Scottish orchestras are flourishing so much at the moment. It's something that I hear people talking about all over the world, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Royal Scottish National Orchestra, with Peter Ungen now, the BBC Scottish Symphony with Donald Runicles, and Scottish Chamber Orchestra with Robert Tichatti. It's just an amazing... I mean, for such a tiny wee country, not that many of us there. Yeah, we've got really great music making going on. Scottish Chamber Orchestra are just fantastic.
Don't forget the Dunedin Consorts. I mean, I'm not much of a period instrument wacko.
Right.
But they are terrific.
Yes.
And every Christmas season on this program, I play three Messiahs. You know, the Beecham, mm-hmm. The first Colin Davis, mm-hmm. and I save one for a period instrument group. I think two or three years running, I've played their version of Messiah.
Oh, wow. That's
tiny, wonderful. Tiny chorus, small orchestra, and they play it like lunatics. I mean, it's like...
I think that's so brilliant, and exactly an approach to Baroque music when you say play it like lunatics, just to be so free and fearless and as feisty as possible. I think that's what the music requires. And
oh, precisely. Well, in the work we just heard, it has many elements of a jam session. Mm. It really does.
Yeah, you have to, and I'm developing that skill all the time, because in some ways it's something you get knocked out of you in your years of training, because things are so controlled. The direction you have in the score is so specific. Your teaching is so detailed, and everything you're taught to do. I mean, you can be told 150 things about two consecutive notes. I mean, it really can be restricting in terms of your freedom and your personality freedom within your playing. And I think doing more study in Baroque music and being exposed and around more Baroque musicians, amongst many, many other things I learned, I think that shone the brightest was just how infectious that sense of freedom is and how important it is for that style of music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is violinist Niccolo Benedetti. She's my guest tonight. She's playing the Brook Violin Concerto with the Pacific Symphony this weekend. Well, speaking of my gene pool, I think Jakub Hruša is maybe the most exciting Czech conductor to come down the pike in years.
He is doing wonderfully well.
In fact, there are those who call him the Czech Gustavo Dudamel. Of course... In Bohemia, they call Gustavo Dudamel the Jakub Hruša of Venezuela.
Yes.
But
it depends
where
you're coming from.
Exactly. I've not actually heard him in the hall, but he sounds immensely exciting.
Oh, he is. He's wonderful. And more than anything else, he has such a depth, and he puts so much value in subtlety and in a sort of emotional state during the performance and also during the rehearsals that is so genuine. And there are a lot of, you know, very impressive young conductors. I would put many other qualities first with Jakub, although he's absolutely extremely impressive, but that's not the first thing that you feel a certain depth and maturity of emotion with him, which I think is so necessary and so needed. And I think concerts and music are it's all there to move people, not to impress people, and I think he's really unique in that respect.
No, and for two such young musicians, I think this is one of the most grown-up sounding recordings recently of the Tchaikovsky. Because it's, I mean, it, not that it's not viscerally exciting and plenty of it, I mean, but it's also, it plays the thing as it is sometimes not played, as though it really is a serious piece of music that's worth getting into.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it is, and I'm a huge Tchaikovsky fan, but I also think we just didn't try to be new and different with the piece. We just sort of relied in an honest sound quality that was going to be as sort of open and forthright as possible. I think we very much agreed on that. We weren't sort of trying to make our mark on this new recording of Tchaikovsky, just trying to be as full-hearted as possible and as genuine as possible, and I'm happy with it.
Well, I guess that makes it unanimous then. And it was much more obvious, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago. But even to this day, the Czech Philharmonic has got its own unmistakable sound.
Yes, absolutely. And them in the Rudolfinum in Prague is something everyone should hear once in their life. They have such an old soul sound and so much sort of nobility. I loved playing with them and I loved the people there. I love the Czech people so much. I went to Prague about 5 times within a year and a half after never having been, and with each visit I just grew more and more and more attached. I mean, I just really felt a lot for those people and for the city.
Yeah, and like London, it's a wonderful walking town.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
And you can walk just about anywhere.
Yes. Yeah.
First time I was there, I walked from Vyšehrad to Hradčany, which is, you know, and I had blisters on every toe, but it was worth it.
It was worth it.
It was totally worth it. Totally worth it. Nicola Benedetti is my guest tonight. This is 91.5 Classical KUSC, Los Angeles. I think the most bizarre thing I ever heard a major violinist say, and I had to think about it a lot, Vadim Repin, who can play anything.
I'm intrigued. I want to know.
Yeah, he can play absolutely. He makes the Shostakovich violin concerto seem like Fiora Lisa. I mean, it just tosses it off like it's nothing.
Yeah.
So I asked him once, so what's the toughest thing you have to play? What's the thing, you know, technically the most demanding thing you've ever played in your career?
I think I might know what you're going to
say. He said, oh, easily, the fourth violin concerto of Mozart.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that. I knew it. No, Mozart is, without a doubt, one of the hardest composers. Absolutely. Agreed. I'm with him there.
Yeah, because he's unforgiving.
He is.
And he doesn't really cut you much slack.
Oh, right.
Do you play the concertos?
Yes, yeah, 3, 4, and 5, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've developed a level of comfort, but every single time I go back to them, I have to rework and... But I think he is obviously so great and such a genius that they deserve that slight angst that you go through. I don't think it should be too easy. It's just the exposure and that simplicity. It's just like playing the most straightforward but fantastically written melodies within a concerto. I see that so much in violin competitions, that people can sound great playing their Paganini caprices, and then suddenly there is the Mozart concerto round, or they're asked to play even just the second movement of a concerto, and suddenly they sound on a totally different level. They sound like they're much worse than they did playing something really difficult.
Sure.
And my theory is partly that to play something that's so simple and so exposed, you have to be at peace with listening to your sound, because there's nothing between you and that. It's just an exposure of your soul, because that's what your sound is. And I think in slow, simple playing, that's at its most exposed. And I think some people don't prioritize it enough. They don't work on it enough, and also they don't value that enough. And I think that's a sad thing, because I think it's one of the most important things.
Yeah. Why don't we continue with those two fragments from Mozart that came with your recording, the Mendelssohn Concerto, which we're going to be hearing a bit later. Not everyone has recorded these little pieces, no. And they're not terribly well known.
No, the Adagio probably more so, but that Rondo, not so much. I had actually been working on them quite a bit with my violin teacher. They were both pieces that he loved and he encouraged me to play, so it seemed like it made sense for me to put them on the recording.
Yeah, yeah. And why don't we follow those by a couple of little pieces by a guy who never wrote a concerto, period.
No.
Franz Schubert.
So sad.
Isn't that?
We've got the trios and chamber works, but no, no concerto.
German violinist who arranged the last of the Schubert pieces. It always looks like a misprint. His name is Wilhelm with a J.
Yes.
And that's how the guy, I should talk about weird spellings. But it's kind of a temptation, I would think, for a proofreader to correct it.
But
the good ones know better.
Know better.
And you also conducted in the Mozart.
Wouldn't say conducted, but directed. I was playing with Academy of St. Martin the Fields, who are used to playing on their own anyway without a conductor. So it was just a case of us very much collaborating between me and the concertmaster.
Yeah.
But it's something I do a lot of. I just performed in Concertgebouw Mozart Concerto, and that was also with no conductor. So I enjoy that. I think I've actually not enjoyed so much often experiences that I've had of doing Mozart pieces and concertos with conductors. Sometimes it can be a little bit heavy, a little bit stiff.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. And it seems like chamber music is absolutely vital to your musical life.
Yes, it's very, very important. It's something I did a lot of at Yehudi Menuhin School, and then for the few years following didn't do so much of. I found it quite difficult because I wasn't at college or in an institution. I was very much sort of on my own, having lessons privately. And so I just didn't really have that community there in order to tap into. And so when I got to 18, 19, I was really desperate to get back into a lot of chamber music. And since then, have done quite well with playing in a regular trio and doing a lot of chamber music festivals.
Yeah, yeah. You played with a good friend of mine, a certifiable lunatic, Jean-Yves Thibaudet.
Yes.
Who drives?
I'm not saying yes to him being a lunatic. Not at all.
It's not a well kept secret. The last time before this most recent one that we did a show, we did a whole evening of Erik Satie.
Wow.
It was 5 hours, and it started kind of seriously, and then the sheer wackiness of the whole thing took over. And he's, and as you know, a big car freak.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've seen at least one of his cars.
That is violinist Nicola Benedetti. She's my guest tonight. This in advance of some concerts with the Pacific Symphony, with whom she's playing the G minor violin concerto of Max Bruch. She's my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC Los Angeles and HD1. We are the member-supported broadcast service of the University of Southern California, home of the USC Fisher Museum of Art. Well, speaking of your time at the Menuhin School, did you have much contact with the only life peer ever born in San Francisco that I can think of?
I didn't that much. I started there when I was 10, and Yehudi Menuhin died before my 12th birthday. In that year or two, was very fortunate to actually do a tour playing Bach double violin concerto with a great friend of mine under his direction. So we got to spend some time with him then. But at 10, 11, there's only so much you absorb. I mean, I remember the experience very vividly, and I was absolutely in awe and always clinging on to each and every word. But I was actually due to go to his house for lessons on Bach A minor concerto. He'd invited me to play that with him following the Bach double experience, and that was due to begin 3 weeks after he passed away.
So. Yeah, yeah. One of that species of great violinist, and you include people like Jacques Thibault and Arthur Grumio, a very great musician who almost incidentally happened to play the violin.
Absolutely, yeah. But young Menuhin recordings, I mean, I find it very sad in music circles how he is often... I'm even like ashamed to admit that, but he's often not considered to be one of the he's considered to be one of the great musicians, one of the great figures, obviously almost the most legendary figure in music in recent times, but I just in terms of violinistically, many people put a lot of other violinists first, but if you listen to his early recordings, purely violinistically, never mind his sound and his vibrato and his soul and his unbelievable connection with the listener. He was just an unbelievable violinist.
Oh, the Bach solo partitas and...
Just amazing. His recording of all the concerti, all the... So many small miniature pieces. You know, I don't hear a difference in level of playing between that and Heifetz, and yet they're often not spoken of in the same way. I can understand why that happened because of Yehudi's difficulties sort of later on in his life, but... I just think that's such a sad thing. I'm really one of his biggest fans.
Oh, that's two of us. Not simply because at the age of 16, he made the recording of the greatest of all violin concertos. I hate to have my prejudice burst forth, but I really think the Elgar is, as a matter of fact.
The Elgar's a great piece, yeah.
You mention it in the same breath with the Brahms. Mm. I've never been very fond of the Beethoven. I know violinists are.
I have to tell you that it's my number one.
Well, wouldn't I have known?
No, can't practice that concerto without getting totally carried away. It's one of the few pieces that I'm unable just to be sort of pragmatic towards in my practice. Every time I start practicing and I'm thinking I'm just going to work on the opening theme, and or I'm just going to work on the development, and I'm just going to, you know, work on the intonation and the sound, before I know it, I'm at the end of the first movement and I've been carried away in this, you know, in this love affair with the piece. It sounds really cheesy and ridiculous, but that's how it makes me feel. And I performed it just a week or so ago with Pletnev, which was a fantastic musical experience, and I'm in love with that piece.
I see.
Hence I'm going on about it. I'm so sorry.
Do you do the Elgar?
I know it, but I actually have not really performed it, not properly.
Okay, well then, after you do that, Well, speaking of great English violin concertos, and there are a bunch of them, the Elgar, the Walton, E.J. Morin wrote an absolutely stunning violin concerto. This big new piece by Sir John Taverner, I mean, I've only heard it a few times. Mm. I did hear the world premiere, as we mentioned earlier. But, to use a tired cliche, if there had not been a Sir John Taverner, he would have had to have been invented. And I can't imagine who would do it. I mean, he's, along with everything else, in the grand tradition of the great English eccentrics, which I say in the most admiring sense,
back to
Blake.
Yes.
And Lord Berners and stuff.
I understand.
In fact, he's so eccentric that even the English might notice.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. So tell me about your experiences with this. I was about to qualify unique, which you can't do. It's
no,
like pregnant.
You can't.
But this utterly unique man.
Yeah. He is utterly unique and extraordinary. And he's one of the people I could liken to Yehudi Menuhin in that he enters a room and he can be the opposite end of a concert hall from you and you feel that something's changed. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but he really has something. He has a quality that's like, it's unearthly. It's really, it's almost spooky being around him. I've never felt so affected by someone's presence as much as I have his. And working with him, going to his home, working through the piece, discussing things. I was required to improvise quite a bit during that concerto. I had to sort of write these sort of improvisations where there was a drone underneath. And just on anything I approached with him and discussed with him, there was always something totally unexpected that would come out of his mouth. And I really I value the time I spent with him so hugely. I think he's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. Maybe a word or two about the piece itself, beginning with, what does the title mean?
It's been a while. So you're asking me, it's been a while since I've been working on the piece. It's based on a old Indian saint, I believe. And she was a woman, I think, who wrote a lot of poetry and was very wild character. I mean, she would sort of take part in these crazy dances and rituals, but a real sense of a free spirit. And I think John Taverner was trying to capture that in the piece. But as I'm sure you remember and have heard, that the piece's structure is very unusual. It's not really it's definitely not a concerto structure whatsoever. It's, in actual fact, a theme, and that's followed by five cycles, which develop each time and grow each time and are much more challenging violinistically in each cycle, with these sort of interjected moments of improvisation. So I spent a lot of time working on that piece just in a darkened room, trying to imagine that I'm something other than a British violinist playing, you know, a classical music instrument that I've studied, you know, for X amount of years. I just had to try to... And also, there's a beautiful, beautiful theme that comes in pretty much every cycle, where you're having to connect the notes in a way that you would never usually do in classical music, all played on the lower string. And I had to try to become a voice, and not in the sort of European music tradition sense. So basically into Indian classical music. And it was an amazing experience for me. I think having a sense of variety in what you do in that respect is brilliant. And to have a composer that you're working alongside introduce you to such a new sound world was brilliant.
I have to ask you, I mean, it was a traumatic event, I'm sure, having your string break. But did you stay for the rest of the concert, by any chance?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
And I have to admit, I didn't even know you were playing that night.
Because, oh, really?
I just checked London, whatever it is, and I saw Andy Litton doing Elgar 2.
Yes.
The greatest symphony ever written. So I figured, you know, I can't miss that.
Yeah. No, he is so wonderful with Elgar.
With just about anybody.
Yeah, no, that's true. He's fantastic. I'm such a huge fan of him, and I love him so much. He's just such a brilliant character, such a lovely person.
Have you been with him in Bergen?
No, no, not yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, hope so. Yeah, because the best opera conducting I've heard in this town. He did a Tosca at LA Opera.
And oh yes, yeah.
You go hear the conducting, who was singing, who cared. I mean, it was brilliantly well sung.
Yeah.
But the conducting was so astonishing.
He just explodes with passion for what he's conducting, doesn't he? I mean,
he really does.
He's brilliant.
Well, and I rank that with one of the two or three great Elgar moments I've had.
Really?
Yeah, it was just...
No, it was a fantastic performance. I remember it very clearly.
Fabulous. That is violinist Nicola Benedetti. She's my guest tonight. This in advance of some performances this weekend with the Pacific Symphony. She's playing the Violin Concerto of Max Bruch. Well, one of the seven works for violin and orchestra by Max Bruch, the one that really gets played a lot, along with the Scottish Fantasia. We're spending this evening listening to recordings by Nicola Benedetti here on 91.5 Classical KUSC, Los Angeles. Let's round out the hour with some music by, I think, the great what if of 19th century French music. I mean, what if he had been as adept a bicycle rider as he was a composer and hadn't died in his mid-40s? Ernest Chanson, one of the unique talents of that time.
Yeah, it's a very, very tragic end. And I love his work. And I think for a piece that is so unusual in its form and its length for being an orchestral violin piece, it's still programmed all the time. And I just think that's a testament to how great the piece is and how much it moves people and how much musicians love it and audiences love it, because it can be awkward to program sometimes because you're usually booked to do, you know, a concerto length piece. But I'm often asked to perform that work, which I'm always very happy to do.
Yeah, yeah. And to do it right, which you certainly do here, I think it has to be played in one big phrase.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. You have to have the end in sight at the beginning. It's a very, I don't know, you have to pace yourself very well with that piece because you start so still and so small and you end so still and small with this sort of numerous climatic moments in the middle, but a little bit similar to Szymanowski Concerto in that respect.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, your Italia album proves that there's a lot more to Giuseppe Tartini than the Devil's Trill Sonata.
Yes.
In fact, I think the concerto is a much more interesting, important work, at least to my ear.
No, it's to mine also, actually, although I love both. The Tartini was the most tender moments we had in the whole recording session. He was so sentimental, but in a good way, just so tender and so different to Vivaldi, who's just so wild. I'm so moved by that concerto and the sort of the subtleties and the use of both solo and the trio violins that is the second movement of the concerto, and it's just so unusual and so sweet. It shows a very different side to Tartini, and in some ways I think The Devil's Trill was Tartini emulating a totally different character. Doesn't really represent his character nearly as much as the concerto does.
Yeah. Have you been looking at any other Tartini things because of this?
Oh, yes, I did at the time. I can't quite recall what. I actually looked at a lot of Tartini repertoire at the time. But no, I'm hoping to do more both Baroque performance and recordings, so Tartini will definitely be in there.
Yeah. Do you use a Baroque bow?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, sounds like.
Yes.
Sounds like. Concerto in A minor by Giuseppe Tartini, and performance by violinist Nicola Benedetti, and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra led by Christian Kernan, who, as we were listening to that, you told me, is quite a character.
Yes, no, he is just infectious. He got everyone really whipped into shape for this repertoire. Obviously, he has so much experience with it. We had a long rehearsal schedule and we also had four performances before the recording, which was ideal, and so we really got to be quite daring with the repertoire, and he's just such a musician, such a great musician.
Yeah. It's kind of a silly question. Do you enjoy the recording process?
It's not a silly question at all, and not hugely is my answer, and should I be honest about that? No, I actually enjoyed recording Italia more than I have enjoyed any other recording session. That and The Taverner, I would say, were the most truly enjoyable recording experiences I've had. I just find the whole recording thing quite stressful and quite intense. I often feel slightly inhibited and a little bit self-conscious, and well, it's taking experience, basically, for me to really sort of relax into it. I mean, I trust that I can do it and I can pull it off and that it's fine, but I hope in the future I'll be able to take more risks in the recording studio and just experiment a little bit more. I tend to sort of be... I'm always very, very well prepared. I leave plenty of time and I'm always very well prepared, but I tend to be ever so slightly on the safe side. So I'm hoping to sort of develop that more.
See, it doesn't sound that way at
That's
all.
That's good. Very good. I mean, we're talking subtle levels here.
Oh, yeah. Very, very. Because, I mean, you know, something that is not subtle in the sense that it's not obvious. I mean, these feel like performances. They don't feel like people getting together in a recording studio and recording something because they have a contract that says they have to do it. I mean, it sounds like...
That's very good news. Thank you.
It's real music making. That is Nicola Benedetti. She's my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC, Los Angeles. Well, Joseph Joachim, among others, mentioned the Bruck Concerto with the Brahms, the Mendelssohn, and the Beethoven. You're obviously fond of it, or at least you play it as though you're very fond of it.
No, I am very fond of it. I think it's very unusual in its positivity. For a big romantic concerto, I think so much they can be very tragic and very dramatic. And I think this concerto is just... It's just beauty from beginning to end. And the second movement, unlike a lot of other concertos, really being the heart and soul of it, I think, and being very meaty. I mean, you can really, really get into that second movement. There's so much material there and so much development of the material, and such an amazing theme. I mean, the opening theme is just... I never, in rehearsals, recordings, performances, get bored of that or I'm unmoved by it. I'm a huge fan of the concerto.
Yeah. Is it possible for a Scottish violinist not to play the other big Max Bruch
piece? Oh, no, I play it. And equally, the last three performances I did were in Scotland of Scottish Fantasy. So that went down well. Yeah.
I would imagine. Yeah, I think the case can be made that Scotland is the most beautiful country on earth.
I mean, it's a really... I'll say thank you for that. No, I absolutely agree. I think it is so stunning. Anyone who hasn't been, I'm always badgering everyone to go to Scotland. Oh. It's an amazing place.
Go to the Isle of Skye.
Yes.
For instance.
It's just... full, absolutely packed full of beauty.
Yeah. Our two dogs are from there.
Really?
Well, they're not from there. We have West Highland White Terriers.
Oh, so, nice. You know, wow.
And I saw absolutely none on our last trip. We were
really
so disappointed.
Oh, that is disappointing.
Yeah. Well, you go to Cawdor Castle, and you've got all kind of Westie stuff.
Yes. You
Westie books, Westie stuff. And the lady said, I thought you would see a whole pile of them by now. And I said, no. Haven't seen one. Here is the Violin Concerto in G minor by Max Bruch in a performance led by a man from the place where they actually invented the bagpipes. They perfected them in the Highlands, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But they're a Bohemian invention, like the polka. To ask you the obvious question, well, obvious for me, do you play the Dvořák?
Yes, but also not hugely obvious for you, yeah. Not very much. I don't know. I know a lot of concertos that I take my time working into performing very publicly. So a lot of pieces like I've done with amateur orchestras or with orchestras in sort of hidden away places in the UK where nobody really is, you know, just not terribly exposed. Because I just don't think there's a rush to be playing everything everywhere.
No, of course not.
But that's such a beautiful concerto.
And
really hard as well.
It's and it won't play itself.
It's got some really
serious problems. What are some of the other things you're working yourself into, if I may ask?
Sure. I'm trying to think of what I'm playing at the moment. Well, Stravinsky and Shostakovich and Brahms, obviously the Korngold, all of the things that will be on my next disc, which I'm learning. We're doing some Korngold arias as well, some really beautiful pieces, a lot of chamber music. I'm doing some trios, Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, and also Shostakovich quintet for the first time, which should be really wonderful. Mahler quartet also. Oh, I'm forgetting loads of things, but there's a lot of repertoire.
Oh, there's tons. And that's the nice part about this kind of music. Yeah. You just never run out.
No, you definitely don't. I'm not even going to... I'm not going to make it to the end of it all, I don't think.
Well, no one ever does. No. No one ever does. Do you have people who advise you in any sense about what you should be looking at, or do you just trust yourself completely?
No, I think you just have to go for it and try. I mean, there's been some pieces that I've performed 10 times and I've thought, actually, I'm going to leave that for a year or two and come back to it. Yeah, I think it just depends on the repertoire and on your time scale. But people can, of course, say, I think this would really suit you. Why don't you try to play this? Why don't you try to play that? And, of course, orchestras are always asking for a certain repertoire. They're asking, can she come and play this and that?
What do orchestras typically ask you to play? I mean, is there two or three things you keep hearing all the time?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
It's very, very varied. Depends greatly on their season, on who else is playing what. On maybe what they've heard of me or what they've heard me play before. They will come to a performance of Sibelius and ask, can you come and play this? And it depends. But I don't see any sort of stuck pattern
for
what they ask me to play.
That's a good sign. That's a very good sign. that is Nicola Benedetti. She's my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC, Los Angeles. Well, I promised the Pacific Symphony to get you out of here at a decent hour. but let's round out the evening with your recording of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. I should say the Mendelssohn E minor Concerto,
yes.
Because there is another one, of
yes.
course. Have you looked at that one?
Or
is
yes,
that,
yeah, yeah, when I was, just after I left school, actually. Yeah.
And what do you think?
I think it's nice. I think it's very beautiful. But there's also a violin and piano concerto, isn't
mm-hmm.
there? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're both beautiful concertos, but I don't think they're very light. They're very classical, actually. So they wouldn't go in the category of sort of, you know, the big great romantic concertos, which I think most people sort of associate Mendelssohn as one of them. Although there is a slightly sort of earlier sound.
Yeah, exactly. And the recording you made of the Mendelssohn Concerto, the conductor is a very unusual choice. I think you're one of the most exciting composers in the world today.
Yeah.
And again, talking about, you know, I don't want to say it's an eccentric, but talk about a really powerful personality.
Mm.
Guy who's a fiercely nationalistic
mm-hmm.
Scot,
mm-hmm.
a fire-breathing Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of guy who's each and every piece is
something to say.
Just unforgettable, I think. And I think he's getting better and better.
Yeah. I really feel nothing other than honored to have had a piece written for me by him and to have him on that disc. And I'm very proud that he is representing Scotland with his compositions, very much so.
Yeah, we're talking, of course, about James McMillan.
So,
good friend of mine is, I think, maybe Scotland's greatest living composer,
yes.
Thea Musgrave,
yeah.
who lives here.
Really?
Yeah,
yeah.
She
oh, yeah.
kind of flits back and forth, goes and getting a lot of commissions these days from the old sod.
Mm.
And just wonderful, wonderfully eccentric lady.
Mm.
You know, I tend to love eccentrics, as you may or may not have gathered. Nicola Benedetti is in town for concerts with the Pacific Symphony. She's playing the Brooke Violin Concerto. And when next you're in town, come back with the next batch of recordings. Because if they're anything like this batch, they're absolutely worth hearing.
Thank you so much.
Again
really
and again.